Hi, hello. We have another jam-packed episode of The Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we talk about the Denver Nuggets. We talk about the Houston Rockets, a couple of Western Conference powers. We salute the Detroit Pistons, and we keep an eye on the Toronto Raptors. Then we get a little bit of breaking news. We got some news in Dallas. And then we finally dig into whatever is happening in Memphis right now. We had a really nice basketball conversation about why it's felt so wonky. It ends a player shout-out. So stick with us. We hope you enjoy the episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here, and ready to talk some basketball, Nikias Duncan, but because it's been nonsensical and wild and fun and fantastic, and I know this is normally where you swing the rock, but we are recording after an unreal night of NBA basketball where Cade Cunningham lost his mind, and Grayson Allen had 42 points and made 10 threes. CJ McCollum had 42 points. Victor Wembanyama went ahead and decided, hey, this game is over, it's done. Done with Andrew Wiggins, buzzer beater, Desmond Bane, buzzer beater. Anthony Edwards also did a lot of things. Luka was cooking as well. Mm-hmm. It was an insane night. So I want to give a quick salute to that.
No, that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. That's why you have League Pass and the various streaming apps that you need to watch basketball this year, because you never know when a night like this is going to pop off. So I'm glad you got there first. So naturally, I'm going to start with a team that was not part of the wild festivities on Monday night. We're going to roam the baseline. Let's talk about the Denver Nuggets really quickly, Steve. As of recording, 7-2 record. They are third in offense, second in defense, second in net rating per clean the glass, removes garbage time there. What a start this has been. First full season under David Adelman. Got some roster tweaks. We're going to get into that a little bit later. But first, you have to start with Nikola Jokic. One, congratulations on yet another Player of the Week award. Salute. As of recording, Steve, Jokic averaging 25.2 points. Seems pretty good. He's converting 77% of his shots inside the arc, which is so nonsensical, it feels like a typo until you read it or watch those clips. 35% on threes after a somewhat slow start. That's terrifying. 87% from the line, getting there a good fit. 13 boards a game among the leaderboard there. 11.9 assists, which leads the league and is absurd. And nearly 2 steals per game. He is once again staking his claim or strengthening his claim as the best player in the league. There isn't a thing offensively that he can't do. This is something that we should know by now about Nikola Jokic, as he is very much going to be in the thick of this MVP race, barring injury or something wild happening. But he's been absurd. And kind of zooming out from the Jokic experience, as he is kind of the center of this, figuratively and literally. We talk about the Miami Heat and like, hey, they're not running pick and roll or handoffs, and like that's kind of been the extreme shift with their offense. The Denver Nuggets are posting you up and posting you up a lot. It isn't necessarily new, but the volume is higher. And I'll present a quick number to you, Steve. Mm-hmm. There have been, since the 2013-14 season, 92 teams that have averaged at least 10 post-up per sessions per game. The 13-14 Memphis Grizzlies have the highest number there at 19.8, right?
Yeah, I know who's on top, buddy.
Yeah, I think you might remember that offense finally. As of recording, the Denver Nuggets generating 1.23 points per possession on any trip featuring a post-up, which is easily the best mark in the league. Not only is that the best mark in the league, that would be the highest clip of the track and data era. We are quite literally in the midst of, or they're on track to be, the most efficient high-volume post-up offense of the last decade plus. And I would wager, I just don't know if there are teams in the 70s putting up 1.2 points per possession on post-ups. I'd wager to say it's probably going to be the most efficient post-up offense ever, but at the very least, they're doing some wild stuff. And what made me laugh when I looked this up, Steve.
Now hold on. We do have to respect the pre-tracking era. I imagine, I mean, come on. Can we salute Will Chamberlain? Come on.
Sure we can. Sure we can. Salute the Will. We'll never forget 61-62 or 66-67 or 71-72, whatever iteration of Wilt you want. That's fine. But I looked this up. It's like, all right, cool. The Denver Nuggets are on top. Whose record are they breaking? Oh, the 23-24 Denver Nuggets. Who had the highest clip before that? the 22-23 Nuggets, who barely edged out last year's Denver Nuggets. It's just like, huh, there seems to be a through line here of what they do and how efficient they are with their post offense. But Jokic has naturally been absurd. He's been the league's best post scorer, leads the NBA in post-up possessions. But as we talked about a little bit earlier in the season, these Aaron Gordon random steals and post touches and the way that they get to them, Jamal Murray setting a bat screen for Murray, for Aaron Gordon, he cuts in. He's just bullying some smaller defender and getting easy ones. So you get that stuff from Aaron Gordon. You get the random Jamal Murray wants to put his back to the basket against a smaller guard. You go to the second unit. Here's Jonas Valanciunas. He's ready to beat you up on the block. Mm-hmm. And so it has been kind of funny, not necessarily new, but like the degree of this has been a joy to watch. It has been extremely efficient. And then you get into Murray Jokic pick and roll or some of the handoff stuff, some of the off ball fun that they can get into overall. The offense has been electric.
Let's stick with the post-ups because I think it kind of just speaks to the overall ethos for Denver, in which we can do a lot of things well, but we're going to try and add to the table and just refurbish this and make this a little bit better. I think that part of that is the empowerment of Aaron Gordon. I think that really has an impact for Denver. It's one thing to say, oh, he's averaging 20 and 5. It's another to kind of look at how he's getting it and bringing the ball out the court and initiating, looking to attack. And now he's a threat from the start, as opposed to, hey, we need you at the dunker spot. We need you in the short corner. We need you as a screener. No, man, I'm bringing it up. I'm in pick and roll if I decide not to put my head down. And now we flow into Jamal Murray. You know, Jokic can always get it. And the versatility of the team is a whole bunch of people can play with him. And so you just kind of find a more dynamic attack and more of a rhythm to what you're doing.
Yeah, I like that point. And like, actually, we can kind of flow from there. Because as you mentioned, Aaron Gordon, he's been one of my favorite players to watch this year. I'm curious to see what the all-star conversations are going to look like between him and Jamal Murray, who is also off to a tremendous start. It's good to see him looking healthy. Good to see him looking spry. Drives are up. If you care about blow-by rate, that's also up. So he's winning these he's driving more and winning them more cleanly, more consistently. He's knocking down pull-ups. Again, can sprinkle in around the post-up if you want to. When you have that kind of early juice from Jamal Murray versus what we've become accustomed to, where it's Murray is fine, but he's kind of like warming his way into the season. We're going to hit a point in which he just stops missing shots. It's like, oh, snap, he's here. The fact that we are getting that level of Jamal Murray at the beginning of the season, in addition to this Aaron Gordon growth and the expansion of his role and the confidence growing there, in addition to Nikola Jokic, which I'll quickly posit to you, Steve, this has to be the happiest he's been offensively, right? Let me just get my smooth 20 to 25. I'll just pass it to all of y'all. If nothing happened within the first 12, 14 seconds of the shot clock, fine. I'll score because it can't stop me anyway. But we're going to let y'all get going. I want to pass the ball and be done by the third quarter if I can help it.
No, yeah. And I think, again, that kind of brings it to that starting lineup where, hey, anyone can bring the ball up. So it doesn't necessarily have to be, hey, Yoke, let's get you the ball. He could space. So to your Aaron Gordon post-up point or your Jamal Murray post-up point, or even when they have – I remember in the preseason they played him with JV. Jokic spaced, and that's a fun concept. Like, he's just behind the 3-point line. Like, this is great, fantastic. So I think it's kind of an equal opportunity type deal, and it's not all based on cutting. We can get to the random cutting, and we can just kind of flow and play and do things as opposed to it has to be this.
Yeah, and I think just the flow from there. Like, then you get the Christian Brown of it all with his drives, his shot making, what he does in transition. You get to the second unit where Tim Hardaway Jr. is just shooting any and everything and his doing his thing. Oh, go ahead.
Can I pause you real quick and just kind of raise your question? You talked about Jokic. Is there a soul happier to be on the Denver Nuggets than Tim Hardaway Jr.?
Yes, Bruce Brown.
Ah, yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
I'll give you that one. But no, to the actual heart of your question, he has been hand in glove. He's like, excuse me, my job is what? Come off of what screen and shoot the ball? Space and then do what when I get shoot the ball? Bet. I don't mind taking 5, 6, 8, 10 of these if I need to. I know I'm going to be open. You can't account for all of us. And so to your point, like, yeah, I think Tim Hardaway Jr. is enjoying where he is and the looks that he's getting. And I think the Denver Nuggets are enjoying the level of shooting and just consistent aggression that he's provided, which serves as an interesting contrast to the Cam Johnson start. I don't know if you want to get – actually, I'll pause on the Cam Johnson portion first. Stay positive. This Denver Nuggets defense, Steve.
These are words you have not put together in the history of this podcast. I'm very intrigued. Not with that inflection, I'll tell you that much.
Hey, man, as I mentioned at the top, second best defense in the NBA right now, as of recording, per Cleaning the Glass, they have been pretty much all year, and this is the thing that I really haven't gotten to say a lot about the Denver Nuggets in the history of this podcast. They've been a very good transition defense, Steve. I feel like there has been a point in every Denver season, whether they are just like bad defensively, average defensively, like the top 10 finish, there's always like a point in the year where it's like, well, the Nuggets are 3-3 in their last six games, and insert head coach is upset about the transition defense effort. The Nuggets have given up 38 in the first quarter because they didn't get back, yada, yada, yada. We really haven't gotten much of that so far this year. Looked it up this morning as I was prepping for the pod. They're fourth in transition frequency allowed, which is just the percentage of possessions that are in transition. So they don't allow you to run that often. And when you do, and this is the more volatile number, they're second in transition points per possession allowed. Again, that kind of fluctuates just because of the nature of the possession and who's taking shots, et cetera, and how they're getting them. But for the Denver Nuggets, for what we've known about them over this era, to be in the top five in both right now to start the year is pretty incredible. And again, it's easier to do that when your half-court offense is absurd and you're scoring a bunch, so teams just don't have a bunch of those opportunities anywhere. But the fact that when they are in those positions, they're doing a better job of matching up, they're building their wall early, like that is a positive sign. I think that is a David Adelman. He deserves a hat tip for really pushing the thread and needle on that front.
Well, I mean, the thing about Coach Adelman is there's going to be standards. There's going to be non-negotiables. There's going to be things that we do every single night. And so we're going to take the easy ones off the board as much as we can. And so now you have to deal with us in the half court. And we're working to do different things in the half court. You know, Jamal Murray is working his tail off defensively. If he has a bad matchup, I'm fronting. We're helping. We're rotating. They just have they've always been based on activity, but there's a little bit more decisiveness to it with them on the defensive end so far this year. And so I think just being able to kind of not get dinged in transition on top of what are we going to do in pick and roll? How are we going to handle this? It just kind of gives you a little bit of comfort. Yeah, you know what you're going to do. You know how you're going to attack. You know how you're going to rotate. You play out of
it. Yeah. So it's been good to see them kind of establish that stronger base. You have the mixture of Jokic, he's at the level. Sometimes he's in a drop. Sometimes he's in a deeper drop. That's fine. They're also sprinkling in more zone. Like, we certainly got a preview of this during the OKC series in the postseason last year. But now, the Denver Nuggets, third in zone possessions per game, about eight a game. They averaged a shade under four last season, so that rate is way up. And the different ways that they get to it, the different lineups they deploy that in, have been interesting for me to track so far this year. And so this was one of the things that I was excited about heading into the season. I said David Adelman was going to be my coach of the year pick when we did the roundtable for Yahoo Sports. I'm just like, hey, this seems like offense is going to be really good. We're going to see a very obvious jump from, you know, defensive rating was here, now it's here, they're doing different stuff. And that's kind of played out in the early portion of the season so far. And so it just felt like time to give some props to the Denver Nuggets for how well they played on both ends of the floor to start the year.
I respect it. I understand it. Did you want to talk about the Cam Johnson at all? Or
like, as a fan, like, not really, but as an analyst, kind of have to. This has not been the start for Cam Johnson that I envisioned. I was very excited about the trade, and overall, I still am excited about it. Like, I haven't given up on this being a good fit for him and stuff like that. But to that point, he's averaging 8 points per game right now, 51% on twos, 24% from three, 86% from the line. He has been dealing with, I think, some sort of shoulder issue, so I would imagine that is affecting at least some of this. I think for me, it has been, you know, the shot making is going to come. We've just seen Cam Johnson shoot the ball for too many years to think he's suddenly a bad shooter. And again, if it is a shoulder issue, like, that's naturally going to affect that. But before the revelation of shoulder, it did feel kind of odd. Like, okay, what exactly is the usage for Cam? Because heading into this, it's like, okay, cool. They're going to give him the MPJ package in terms of the off-ball stuff. They're going to allow him to initiate more pick and rolls than they allowed MPJ to do. He's a better driver, so if you do have closeout attacks, there's going to be more paint touches there, and it's just going to be a more holistic experience. And there's a little bit more faith for me defensively, at least on the ball, with Cam. And so far offensively, like, the volume of the off-ball usage hasn't been to where I thought it was going to be. Now, naturally, if you are just having this much fun beating up folks, and again, Aaron Gordon, Jamal Murray, Jokic all cooking, there's only going to be so much, but it is a little bit lower than I anticipated. There have also been like some swing sequences where Cam is looking to make, we're going to turn a great into an excellent instead of just taking the great. Like, I think there are some shots that he's passed up on, some scoring opportunities that he can afford to be more aggressive with. And so how much of that is, I'm not 100% versus I'm trying to find my footing here. I don't want to rock the boat. Like, I don't know what that balance is, but it has felt like at least a little bit of that. So not concerned, but it is worth saying this hasn't been the Cam Johnson that I thought we were going to get in Denver so far.
Well, I think part of it is Denver is a little different than we thought they were going to be this year. As far as, I don't think you anticipated Aaron Gordon to do all of this offensively. So if you talk about the MPJ package, Aaron Gordon kind of took a lot of that in a different way. So I'm going to take this bulk here. I think the positives for Cam Johnson, the cutting is hit, using him as a screener is hit, the defense is held up, the shot will come. And so I think the positive sign is, I think in the month of October, he shot averaged about 6 field goal attempts a night. In the 4 games in November, he's up to 9, and that's with one game where he only shot 3 times. So that's a plus. And so understanding the rhythm, understanding where the shots are within the offense, staying aggressive, staying ready, it's a rhythm deal. And when you're on a good team in a good position and everyone kind of plays a certain way, okay, let me fit in, and then let me find where I go. And so I think it would be the flip if maybe he just was shooting and missing, and now he regresses to, oh, I don't need to, you know what I mean? You want the confidence to go up and start slow rather than I come out, I'm doing this, oh my, now I'm just passing the ball to Nikola Jokic, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And so again, that's why I'm not like, oh man, this trade is a disaster. What did they do? It's like, it's none of that for me. It's just like, okay, this is interesting. How much of this is help? How much is this mentality? Let's let the sample grow. As you mentioned, like, he is generating value elsewhere offensively, and the defense is held up, so it hasn't been all bad. And so as this regresses to, like, a positive mean, if that's even the correct way to phrase it, I think Cam Johnson is going to be okay. And if he's not okay, I'll just have to take the L on that, but I think he's going to be fine. But it has been odd to start. Can I pose a question to you, Steve?
Yes.
How have you felt about the non-Jokic minutes so far?
I'm fine with it. I like the fact that they have Jonas Valanciunas. I like the different combinations they can throw out there. This is not a thing for me this year. I think the Denver Nuggets are going to be okay with Nikola Jokic. I don't think we have to track this stat anymore. I think society has progressed past this.
Well, I sure hope so. I've been tracking it this year. Have a couple of tweets out there. It's like, okay, well, this is what it is. Oh, no. Why is it still this? We zoom out. Again, as of ahead of the Tuesday slate, rather, the Denver Nuggets, a plus 18.6 net rating with Nikola Jokic on. That tracks. He's excellent. The starting group has been excellent, etc. A minus 0.8 with him off, Steve. So technically losing those minutes comes out to, I think, minus 10 in 131 minutes. But they're pretty much neutral. It's trending in the right direction. Now, their primary non-Jokic lineup has been Jamal Murray, Tim Hardaway Jr., who we just talked about, Bruce Brown, who we talked about briefly, Peyton Watson, who is still just swatting everything, and Jonas Valanciunas. That group is a minus 34 in 53 minutes, which that is just not very good. But as I said before, and even tweeted about, I look at this group and it makes sense to me. I watch this group, at least offensively, and different players that can initiate, different ways they can use JV, Jamal Murray, again, just cooking, and he could be using the multiple ways. Like, I like the group. I expect this to be a solid group. And like, statistically, that hasn't borne out yet. But like, I'm kind of with you. Like, I don't feel like this is an issue. And like, what gives me even more optimism is something that we talked about before. They know that at any given moment, they can just sub in Aaron Gordon for one of these reserves and still have Jokic off the floor. And then they can just get to this and still win. Going back to, I think, the Warriors game on Friday, they had a second quarter run with Murray, Brown, Christian Brown, to be clear, Cam Johnson, Peyton Watson, and Jonas Valanciunas. And they went plus six, you know, outscored Golden State by 16 in 5 minutes to kind of flip that game on its head. Just like, okay, that was the first time that group had played together, which is wild. But this is another variation of Jokic is on the bench that we can get to and feel good about what we're doing on both ends. So, like, I'm not super concerned. I am going to continue to track it, so I'm sorry if I have not progressed enough for you, my dear co-host. But like, it is a positive that overall it's kind of like net neutral. They're not getting blitzed without Jokic anymore. It's like, okay, we're fine. And that's kind of all they needed. They just needed to not be destroyed when he sat down to the bench. The fact that it's neutral or close enough to it, trending upward to slight positive, that bodes well for the Denver Nuggets to me. So just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I respect it. It's good to hear you enthusiastic about the Denver Nuggets as a whole for once. I like that. I have a team that I'd like to talk about, Nikias.
Yes. Who we got?
Let's talk about the Houston Rockets.
Okay.
I've been thinking about the Houston Rockets for a while. Mm-hmm. I've been sitting on it. You know, they end up having a week. You play the Spurs, play the Bucks. I'm intrigued. Let's see how it works. Let's see what it does. And this team is fascinating to me. Right? Mm-hmm. 6-3, which in the Western Conference puts you at, what, like 5, depending on the week.
It's so tough.
But they're first in offensive rating. Fantastic. They're third in points per game at 122.8 a night. They're seventh in field goal percentage at 49%. They're first in three-point percentage at 42.8, which none of us thought was going to be the case.
Nope.
They're also 19th in three-point makes a night at 12, and they are 30th in three-point attempts a night at 29.3. Throw in third in free throw attempts and first in offensive rebounds, 15 a night. And we have a mix of things that are happening that kind of make a unique blend in a sort of way. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, the offensive rebounding point, I appreciate it because you get 15 of your 45 misses back. That's fantastic. I do imagine Ime Udoka would probably like to not lead the league in offensive rebounds because it probably means hopefully they made some more shots, but that's just my opinion. It's just my thought. I think you're really starting to feel the impact of Kevin Durant with this Houston Rockets team, especially offensively, and the ways that defenses have to make a decision. And you see more defenses are like, hey, not you particularly. Mm-hmm. The Rockets really do a good job of working, trying to get him the ball in the middle of the floor. They'll keep him involved in pin downs. This is part of the package for Kevin Durant as far as we can open up the playbook to get some movement around him. Defenses are showing a lot of help. So if you get him the ball in the middle of the floor, there's going to be bodies, there's going to be help. There's going to be nail help. There's going to be help from the baseline. Wherever you're at, we're going to show help. Mm-hmm. Are you going to double him? Are you going to keep that early help? How long are you going to hold it? I think the interesting part is that Kevin Durant plays within the flow of the offense, and he can take and make the shots where it doesn't necessarily matter. So if your early help is in, you know, you see Kevin Durant holds the ball, you see his defender, the other defender looking at him, okay, we get a cut, we clear out, I can still get to my pull-up and make shots. But just the involvement that he has, you know, you go to Horns, where Kevin Durant's a screener and a big, and now even if you go under on Amen, KD's flashing in the middle of the floor. Now we have to think about something. You know, they love to hit Alperen Şengün at the elbow, and they go to a stagger away with Kevin Durant in the same corner with Alperen Şengün. He sets up a backdoor cutter. They play a two-man game with an empty side. You got to make a decision. And so I am just intrigued and excited to see how that continues to grow, because I think the two-man game with him and Şengün has a lot of potential because you have to guard Kevin Durant at a certain level. And Alperen Şengün is really good at getting to his short roll, and that's going to force more help, which opens up either shots for your shooters or cuts for Amen Thompson, Tari Eason, whoever it needs to be. So I think that's been really fun. Alperen Şengün, huh?
Yes.
So without a true point guard, right? It's been a discussion point, but I think this does allow you to play through Alperen Şengün a little bit more. I think the one thing that has intrigued me is that, yeah, we've seen him initiate more, but the drives have increased. And so he's at, I think, 9.6 a night, up from 7.7 last year. You don't know if it's going to be a dribble handoff. You don't know if it's going to be a swing to a pick and roll. You don't know if he's going to just put his head down. And so he puts his head down, gets in the paint, Kevin Durant one pass away. Then the next time it's a dribble handoff with Kevin Durant, that can make things a little tricky. And so you get him the ball in different areas of the floor. You get him the opportunities to impact the game in different ways, get to the line. I think he's putting together a better package. Plus the post-ups. Hey, are you going to double? Do you want to do that? Can I mash real quick? If you switch someone on me, can I mash real quick? Like this is where it's like, okay, that's fantastic. And so I think the dynamic of what those two bring to the table give them balance in the half court in my eyes.
No, I like that. I think sticking on the Şengün point, one, I have just had a blast watching him and the way that the role has expanded. And to your point, the way they move them around, and he can still just kind of get to the power package when he has a matchup. Quickly on the numbers on that front, mentioned Jokic being the best post-up player in the league so far this year. Alperen Şengün on post touches, about 6 per game on that front, 1.13 points per possession on any trip featuring an Alperen Şengün post-up. One of the best marks that we have in the league, especially among the high-volume folks. But it's about 1.1 points per possession on isolation, Steve. It's about 1 point per possession when he's the pick-and-roll ball handler, and you're getting good stuff out of him as a screener as well. And so it almost hasn't mattered. Not only are they moving him in a bunch of different ways, it almost hasn't mattered how he's being used, you're generally getting good stuff. Like, that versatility has really popped. And I think within the overall ethos of this Houston offense, they're trying to figure it out with no traditional point guard. It's cool when you're big, can be this skilled and this versatile, and you can invert the floor and you can create advantages in a different way. And so he's just been very good. You add in the package of Kevin Durant, as you mentioned, which one of those I watched these Rockets games was like, oh, I love when these two are in action together. It's been fun kind of watching them build out the off-ball package together. You don't know if this is going to be KD coming off the screen all the way, if they're going to twirl a little bit, they're going to play with a matchup, if they get a switch. Like, that kind of what's happening here has been fun to watch. I think my broader Houston thought on that front is like, do that. Can we get the ball across half court a little quicker so you have more time to explore that and poke at something? Because some of these Houston possessions do get grindy, or more grindy than I would like. But the seeds are there at the very least. And I like that portion of it. But what surprised me, oh, go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say, let's get back to that tempo point whenever you are finished, because I would like to talk about that. Continue. Sorry.
Okay. Good deal. You're good. You're good. And so it was one of those, I watched the like KD Şengün pick and rolls. I was like, oh, I like this. You don't know if you want to switch. You might mess around, get two on the ball. Now Şengün short rolling, et cetera. And I was like, cool. Let me look up what the actual numbers are on this, because I know it's got to be like 1.2 points possession or something. Look it up. It's 0.84 points per possession on 63 reps with the KD Şengün pick and roll. And I was like, the quality of this is so far outpacing what the actual numbers are right now, and that should scare the rest of the league.
Yeah, that's why you love that eye test, baby.
Yeah,
it's like, find okay, that comfort. Like
this guy. But no, it's just like, okay, this seems good. They haven't gotten it to an efficient clip yet, but I think it's going to get there. The inverse, though, much lower volumes, nearly 1.4 points per possession when you get a Şengün KD pick and roll. I wonder how much more they lean into that version of it. Because that is intriguing to me. And again, that goes to the overall point of Şengün just gets the run. More pick and rolls, Reed Shepard screening for him. Josh Okogie, shout out Josh Okogie, by the way. But Josh Okogie screening for him. Amen Thompson randomly screening for him. So like, they sprinkle it in early offense. How much of that is going to be the KD package late in games with him as a screener for Şengün? I want to see what that looks like. But early returns have been good on that front. But let's go tempo, Steve.
Yeah. Well, I think to the Şengün of it all, him getting a screen from KD, you get an attack of big on the move if they go under. So I like that. I think the tempo is where it gets interesting. So we laid out how KD and Şengün are helping the offense balance things out. What is the right tempo for this team? When the defense is humming, they can push off turnovers, make some easy ones in. They can score quick, kind of be okay, and still kind of grind you in the half court. So when you feel the action starts at 16, they grind you, they make a shot, it has more impact, right? Mm-hmm. You can kind of control the tempo that way. If you have your execution, you have KD and Şengün going, you mix in some other makes from other people, it's great, fantastic. Can they balance that to extend leads? Because there are moments mm-hmm. where they get down by 8 or 10 and it feels like they're down by 15 because, okay, we're taking 8 seconds to get into our first action. Mm-hmm. We're reading the defense after, now we're deep in the clock. So I'm intrigued to see what the right tempo is for them, because I don't think they have to be a team that plays fast. I just think mm-hmm. they have to be a team that is decisive in the half court. And, you know, if they're going to grind it out, it can be to your advantage if that defense is working. Offensively, it can get a little tough.
Yeah, I feel you. And then just quickly looking at it now, last season, average possession length for Houston was around 15 seconds. So far this year, it's at 15.6. And so keeping an eye on what that looks like, I'll get the, like, how long it takes to cross half court, et cetera, a little deeper into this conversation. I'll circle back on that front. Steve, how have you felt about the Amen Thompson lead ball handler experience so far this year?
I enjoy it. I mean, I think what it does is keeps him aggressive in a different way. And so you've seen mm-hmm. the moments where, you know, obviously teams are going to want to either give him a drop or go all the way under. And he takes that space and he attacks and he goes after it. And so I've kind of enjoyed the different ways that he's been able to find ways into the paint. I think that's important for Houston. Mm-hmm. The three-point shot's interesting to see. I don't think he has to be a complete three-point maker. He just needs to continue to be someone who takes the shots. And so can he balance out the, hey, I took 7 against OKC, and now I'm going to take 7 over the next 4 games. I think he's had an incredible knack for timing his cuts on the weak side when he's spaced. I think he just does a really good job of, you know, being able to find open areas. Whether Şengün is posting up, KD is isolating, whatever happens. If he does a post-entry pass because defenses are sagging off, I'm going to fake a cut middle, and then I'm going to flash back to an open area and kind of score. the burden really isn't on him to completely make a bunch of plays. So I think that's probably the best overall point for Houston. How have you felt about the experience?
Like, it's been cool to me. Like, one, I just like that kind of experimentation for with wings just as a concept. And since I enjoy Amen Thompson already, like, cool. Yeah, let's see what these pick and rolls look like. Let's see what it looks like with him running things, initiating things. And so the excitement level for me has been there. In terms of the actual execution, it, like, it's mostly been fine. Like, as he's seen these unders, I've liked how the pick and roll setups look for him. Like, I know you're going under. Let me bob this way, juke this way. Now I can kind of change speeds. I can go full 100 miles per hour, chew up this space. Now you're not having fun with me, beat you to a spot. Or I can slow play this, get into some of these pull-ups that I'm experimenting with. And like, okay, this is cool. I like that he's seeking it out. It doesn't look like he's always playing too fast or he's always too deliberate. Like, I like the mixture that I've seen from him on the ball. And as you kind of zoom out, when he gets off of it, he's just the show. We get the ball to Şengün or something. Let me just quietly trot to the dunker spot. I'm just going to stand right here. I'm just going to stand right here. I'm just going to stand right here. Oh, snap, there's a cut. Or shot goes up. Oh, no, there's another putback slam. Because you can't keep your hands on him. So, like, even when he gives up the ball, you're never really done dealing with Amen Thompson. So, like, that part, in addition to the overall experimentation with him on the ball, the growing comfort, the changing of pace, like, positive signs for me. Now, again, with overall scoring efficiency, with some of, like, the pull-ups off a pick and roll or something like that, like, you want that to continue to grow naturally. But process-wise, I haven't super minded it. I will ask you a quick Houston offense question.
What's up?
As this has been, as you mentioned, very efficient offense so far this year. The tempo stuff, still a work in process. And to that point, about 6.5 seconds in terms of the average time to get to their first action, isolation, off-ball screen, pick and roll, whatever it is. That is dead last in the league. The average possession length that I mentioned a little bit earlier, that is 29th, only ahead of a team that I am going to solemnly talk about a little bit later in this podcast. This is a Houston Rockets team that has turned the ball over a lot. A lot of dead ball turnovers at the very least, so they're not getting blitzed in transition the way they could be. But it has been pretty turnover heavy. Is that just, hey, our bigs initiating a lot, or we have Amen initiating a lot, Reed initiating some? It's just going to be a work in progress, or has there been anything that's like problematic or that's like consistent in their film that's kind of stood out to you on that front?
Work in progress to me. It is something they can't afford with their current team makeup, but work in progress to me. I don't think it's anything where I'm just like, whoa, they can't handle XYZ. I know that it's ball pressure is going to end up being the term that a lot of people are going to look towards. So Houston can't handle ball pressure. They need a point guard. I remain to kind of be okay, because if you have Amen and Alperen doing things, they're not really going to get pressed that much. If a team does, get someone else, and you'll find a counter to that. But I'm fine with it.
Okay. As we saw towards the end of that Bucks game, Giannis pressuring Alperen Şengün and seemed to handle it well on that possession at the very least. They kind of slammed the door on that one. But okay, just figured I would toss that question to you.
I got you. And then my final thoughts with Houston is, okay, how many lineups can they get to? Mm-hmm. They have a lot of optionality on who can close depending on who has it going. But how many of the lineups in between are going to get there? What's the double big of it all? Are we just stamping double big as part of the rotation because we have to now? I'm intrigued by that. I'm intrigued by how much, like, we're going zone. Or how much do we want to continue to go zone as an automatic more than anything else? You know, it's just like, okay, they're going to play zone because these two people are in. Oh, well, the Bucks were like ball movement. We're going to get what we want. And so do you want to put yourself in a position where the zone is no longer the kind of curveball it's been, and it is now just something teams are expecting and ready for?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Nearly 20 zone possessions per game for Houston so far this year. That leads the league way up from last year. They were around 5 last season. In terms of the points per possession allowed on those zone trips, it is slightly lower, which means better compared to last season. However, the average shot quality that they're giving up on those zone possessions is higher. So is there going to be some room for some regression there? Teams shoot better on some of the looks that they're getting? We'll see. Like you mentioned, the Milwaukee example in particular, where it felt like they had a good handle on where they wanted to get their shots from at the very least. And do you get like a missed corner three, you get a wayward pass, but it's like, ooh, they did poke at that the right way. So with a larger sample, to your point, Steve, I am curious to see what that ends up settling in on. But shout out to the Houston Rockets and Josh Okogie, who's been playing well for them. Did you have another team you want to get to?
It's time, Nikias. It's time for you in the basketball world to respect the Detroit Pistons. It's time.
Okay.
It's time. No more games. 7 straight wins. Do you know the last time the Detroit Pistons were at the top of the Eastern Conference standings after 10 or more games were played?
Let's go 06-07?
You are correct. There was a graphic on the TV screen that said 6,000 plus days since, and the Detroit Pistons are on top. And I think what you see is, one, the Cade Cunningham of it all. My gosh, that young man is playing at such a high level. First player with 45 or more points, 10-plus rebounds, 10-plus assists, 5-plus steals since 1973-74. Yes, it was against the Washington Wizards. I understand that. But spare me the efficiency. Keep it on the side. Keep it in the pantry. I don't need it on this dish. To go 8 of 23 at halftime, right? Mm-hmm. He's 10 of 35 at the end of the third quarter. Scores 15 points in the fourth quarter to give the Pistons a chance. Hey, man. Mm-hmm. What have you tried to do 45 times in your life? And would you have gotten to the number 45?
Don't answer that. Don't answer that.
But he's giving this team life in such a great way. Third in league in drives per game at 18.7. You mentioned Jokic is the leader in assists per game. Kay Cunningham is second. And the bonus is Kay Cunningham is averaging 11.4 points per game in the fourth quarter, shooting 53%. Would you like to knock on the door of Clutch Player of the Year? I'm just throwing it out there.
That seems good. That seems good.
And so what that has done is teams are now forced to, we're putting two on the ball. We're going to double team you. And Cade is reading the floor, reading defenses, having more comfort with the, okay, you want to double me if I'm looking to attack? I'm going to drive the other way and make a play. And it's also unlocked, you know, a very good pick and roll tandem with Jalen Duren. And so now you see, okay, if you want to be at the level, we can go empty a side out, take away your help defense, and I can throw a lob to Jalen Duren anytime I want. If you want to go ahead and drop back or allow me the space to drive, I'm coming off in my own tempo. I'm turning the corner downhill, and I can get a bucket however I'd like, whether it's a drive, pull up, whatever it is. Because he plays with his own pace. The straight line drives are there. It's hard to recover. And he's playing with such a comfort and flow, and that gives them, I think, just such a good balance. Cade and Jalen Duren did things to your Brooklyn Nets. both had 30-plus point double-doubles. Very quickly, do you know the last Piston duo to achieve that feat?
2 30-point double-doubles? Is this Blake Griffin era?
It's Andre Drummond and Reggie Jackson.
Oh, okay.
One day we'll get you to respect Reggie Jackson. That's fantastic.
Well, I respect Mr. October.
But yeah, the overall improved play from Jalen Duren on both ends of the floor. And so you're seeing him kind of nail more defensive rotations than he did in the past when he's on the baseline, he's under the rim and he sees someone driving or he sees someone rolling. He's there meeting them, looking to compete. Isaiah Stewart, we know he can do defensively. There's a reason why this team is fourth in defensive rating. And it's funny because you saw last year, there was always the combination of, hey, we need space. We need a playmaker. We need a shooter out there. And it feels like at times JB Bickerstaff's like, hey, let's get some defense out there. Let's get some dog on the court. Hey, Javonte Green, would you like to make someone upset? Ron Holland, you want to get after it? Asar Thompson, you're third in the league in deflections per game. Guard anyone. And so we're just going to bring that impactful behavior to our team and attack you the other way. So I've liked how they get after it. I just like their identity. This is a team where, yeah, you've got internal development, but they have belief. You got your guy, Danis Jenkins, sending them to overtime.
Yes.
So guys are ready and willing to step up, and you get that kind of buy-in and belief early in the season, you never know where that's going to take you.
And we can pause it right here, because you mentioned like the defensive identity. That has been the best part of the Detroit experience. They do not let you breathe, brother. And like the assortment of guys that can pressure you, the active hands, and then you get in the paint. It's like, well, do you really want to deal with this version of Jalen Duren? Now he's blocking your shot. Now he's yelling at you. And he's got the muscles that extend like multiple cities. Like, it's just, like, you don't want that. And it's just like, oh, cool. Well, here's the stretch of games. You know, due to injury, get well soon, Tobias, et cetera. oh, cool. You got Jalen Duren and Isaiah Stewart on the floor together. In which Isaiah Stewart last year, if he like hit the minute threshold, like he's probably in a, he's either on an all defense team or just heavier in the conversation at the very least if he was eligible. This year, he has been even better, it's felt like, defensively, in addition to the growth from Jalen Duren. It's like, okay, well, now it's these two dudes. Now it's Ron Holland, who's probably yelling at me while he's defending me. I don't want to deal with that. Asar Thompson, who's been one of the best perimeter defenders in basketball again. What am I supposed to do? What has me in a bit of a headlock, Steve, an easily reversible one, you know, easy mode, WWE 2K25, whatever. Because the defensive slanted lineups for the Pistons, I think also aids in the high blitz rate that Cade Cunningham is seeing. Because I think teams have gotten comfortable with like, okay, it's not going to be you. And we don't really trust these other dudes to hit enough shots. And I just wonder, like, I don't want to say like how important is the defensive identity, because obviously they're an elite defense and they are at the top of the East for a reason. But it's like, when they get healthier, et cetera, what exactly is that lineup blend going to be? Because I do think we are going to reach a point at some point where it's like, hey, Cade is excellent. It is like a net positive that he's seeing this amount of attention. But then you look at the Pistons generating like 0.61 points per possession on trips when Cade gets blitzed. And it's just like, 4-on-3s are great, but if you're not converting those, what does it mean? And I guess for me, it's more of a playoff question than anything. Like, are teams actually afraid, or are they as afraid to put 2 on Cade as they should be? Because it should just be Cade is a tall playmaker and can make all these reads. You don't want to be in rotation. But when you are having Ron Holland, who's smoother jump shot, but teams still don't care if he's knocking down shots or not. Asar Thompson, teams don't care. And this is why Detroit likes to have him around a dunker spot and stuff like that. Jalen Duren, as you mentioned, is making better short roll decisions. And is the blend of him making the passes quicker and also, well, actually, I'll just take a dribble and dunk on you is a lot of fun. So again, it isn't a guarantee, but that part of it is like, ooh, what does this mean moving forward? Because this is a lot.
Well, I think for me, when you look at this, they're gonna be at their best when they have a blend. So this is Tobias Harris, can you get healthy and hold up? Caris LeVert, can you get healthy and hold up? Duncan Robinson, are you prepared for teams to consistently attack and hold up? And so if those guys can hold up, then you're kind of going to get more of the blend, so you may not need to have two of Ron Hall and Asar on the court. I think it'll happen. I think because they're both talented and they have the trust of David Bickerstaff, but you're not going to have to lean into also Jamonte Green is out here. And so we're looking at three of those type of players next to Cade and Jalen Duren, as opposed to mixing them in throughout the game. And so I think when it comes to the overall of it, I think it's a fair point. You know, I have question marks about the lineups. Can they find the balance on both ends of the floor throughout the season? Because, you know, you're going to take hits when you get to the top. But the fact that Cade is performing well, the fact that Cade is making more plays, and the fact that more teams sit down at the coaches meeting and say, hey, we can't let this guy get into XYZ, is an overall plus, because you can kind of rely on that. You don't want to over-rely on it, but if it's a scenario as opposed to Cade has to make X amount of shots before defense says, hey, stop, kind of take that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Figured I'd just toss that your way. I'm just like, it's not going to ruin the experience for me, but it's just like, I think this Pistons group is just good. They are a little bit better than I expected, but I do think they are going to be good. They're going to make the playoffs barring a catastrophe of injuries. And so once we get into round one, round two, is the game plan is going to be, yeah, we're putting 2 on Cade. Just flat out. The Pistons need to shoot 17 of 38 from three. Over a couple of games before we changed it, huh?
Probably.
Yeah, so well, that's why I'm just like, ooh, back in the head. But I really enjoyed this Pistons run. They have my respect, at the very least. You know who else has my respect, Steve?
Who?
Danish Jenkins. But you know who else has my respect? And we'll be quick. The Toronto Raptors just quietly creeping up the Eastern Conference standings. Just want to put it on the radar. It was a very wonky start. They had that opening win against Atlanta, and then their defense was just, we're pressuring, we're getting beat, oh no. Offense was a bit wonky, and I came on this very podcast, and I was like, hey, I was excited about all this. This defense has been poo. It can't be this, yada, yada, yada. 4-1 in their last five games, Steve. As we zoom out, per cleaning the glass, 11th in offense, 15th in defense, 11th in net rating. They're just a hair out of the top 10 in that front. And during this 4 out of 5 stretch for them, Wins over Cleveland, Memphis, Milwaukee, and Atlanta, and they lost to Philly. Fun game that was, by the way. A near 120 offensive rating in those games, which is eighth in that span, so since October 31st. Third in defensive rating during that stretch. And I will just say, it hasn't been perfect in the half court offensively, but I have enjoyed the way that they are weaponizing their three best players together in Scottie Barnes and Brandon Ingram and RJ Barrett, who once again deserves more of your respect. And like the off-ball package for all three of them has been kind of fun for me to watch. When they bunch up together in a corner, whether it's just half court offense, you don't know if it's going to be a stagger. You don't know if it's going to dart different directions. This sideline play they've been sprinkling in for RJ Barrett, Brandon Ingram just slowly trots, clears out. Then here's RJ Barrett. And then wait, there's a bounce pass to RJ Barrett. He's now pinning some smaller guard underneath the basket for a quick win. Like, that's been fun. But you don't know which way they're going to go. And like within their actions, it hasn't been, again, perfect. But like the intention of, we're going to have something happening on the weak side at all times. There's going to be a pin in somewhere. There's going to be a pin down somewhere. There's going to be a flare somewhere. Even if it doesn't hit, defense have to think, okay, they're doing something. I got to at least keep my eye on it a little bit. And that unlocks some of the RJ Barrett drives. That unlocks some of the Scottie Barnes drives. Or if he's posting up someone, you can't just send the auto help because you don't know what's happening with RJ Barrett and Brandon Ingram and insert other player here. It just frees up driving lanes. It occupies defenders. And like all three of those guys are winning in their own ways. Brandon Ingram with the pull-ups, RJ Barrett with the drive, Scottie Barnes mixing in. That part's been fun. And defensively, it just seems more solid. They've dialed back a little bit of the full court pressure. They've dialed back a little bit of the trapping. There's still a baseline level of activity, but you certainly don't feel it the way it was in like the first three, four games of the year. And I think that has helped them. The offense being better has allowed them to set things up more, obviously. But it does, there is just a level of connection that I am enjoying from this Raptors group so far. So just, you know, I was like, hey, I'm excited. It looked bad. I said it looked bad. It looks good right now. I want to say that it looks good.
There you go. Salute to Canada. I think you did a tremendous job there. But yeah, Nekias, speaking of rap, we're going to wrap this up and go to break where I will talk about the Memphis Grizzlies. And it appears, Nekias, we have some breaking news.
Oh. And we are back. And before we post up SDTs, we do have some breaking news into the podcast. Dallas Mavericks general manager Nico Harrison expected to be fired. His era ends. His error ends. However you want to frame it. No more Nico Harrison in Dallas. And it felt like a move that had to be made. Like when you have PJ Washington at the free throw line during a one possession game, and in the midst of him prepping for his free throws, you hear a loud fire Nico chant happening versus any kind of encouragement or even just silence for like, hey, the home team player is taking free throws. We want him to be able to focus. You're getting that during clutch moments. Like it's become untenable. Like I think the Mark Stein story where he's talking about like the removable stairs that they have so he can exit out without having to go through the, like, if it's all that, you're just kind of in a tough spot. It's been such a cloud over the Cooper Flag experience. I mean, the Luka Doncic moment all kind of speaks for itself. It's, yeah.
Nekias, the What's optics up? Were horrific. They started chanting that, and they've been chanting it since that trade in February, but they started chanting that in the fourth quarter with 7 minutes left of a back-and-forth game with the Milwaukee Bucks, and Giannis Antetokounmpo is right there. Yeah. Cooper Flag had his best game of his career in a sea of fire Nico chants. PJ Washington had a chance to tie the game, missed the second, and in a chance to still, hey, maybe we can get this rebound, fire Nico intensifies. The governor has attended two games. One, Victor Wembanyama hates y'all. Two, this one. Mm-hmm. Three, seated next to a fan in a gold Luka Doncic Lakers jersey. This combination of things does not end well for Nico Harrison.
You can't do it. And it appeared that it has not ended well for Nico Harrison. And it's just, I don't want to belabor it because I want to get to these teams. I just still can't believe that this was a deal that was made. And not only was it a deal that was made, it was a deal that was made without opening up any kind of bidding war. And not only was it a deal that was made without opening up a bidding war, you didn't even max out the assets from the one team you allegedly talked to, or at the very least were serious about talking to. It was malpractice then, it's malpractice now. The fans have been rightfully upset throughout this entire ordeal. And it has not been fair to the fan base. It has not been fair to the players. It has not been fair to Cooper Flagg. Like, it really hasn't been fair to Jason Kidd either, but like, I'm sure that is like secondary to the fans at this point. But it's just been a tough situation. And so hopefully this is step one in regaining whatever semblance of trust you can regain from this fan base after making that kind of move. But like, this Band-Aid just had to be ripped off.
If you are the person that sends Luka Doncic elsewhere, you live with that. And you had maybe this much wiggle room, just about that much, a little bit. And no Kyrie Irving, plus no Anthony Davis. Hey. Nah.
Yeah. We making this move because we want to win now, and you come out with a bottom three offense. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, brother. Guys, if I sell the house to buy an RV and then I blow it up, I can't. No, you got to go.
Yeah, you can't do that. You can't do that. All right, Steve, let's post up. Let's actually stick with a team in the division. I'll let you take the floor. Who are we talking about in this post up section, Steve?
Well, you know, I already gave the tease. We're talking about the Memphis Grizzlies. And yeah. I personally have sat back. I've sat back on this subject for a few reasons, right? Mm-hmm. One, did not want to jump out the gym with some of the takes that I've seen regarding the Grizzlies and the head coach and Ja Morant and everything. I think there's a lot going on here. And I think it's a combination of different things that are happening that are putting them into a tough spot. It's obviously growing pains, right? Mm-hmm. Growing pains for almost everyone involved. If you ask any coach, they'll probably tell you the slide from the assistant coach chair to the head coach chair, one of the tougher ones. It becomes even more difficult if you are sticking with the same team. You would imagine probably easier. To a degree, you do have some built-in relationships, but your role changes. Your dynamic mm-hmm. changes, things shift, and you are now trying to bring in your philosophy mm-hmm. based on what you've seen that this team may need, based on what you do well, and you got to balance that out. Mm-hmm. With this Memphis Grizzlies team, we've seen during the highs and lows of the Ja Morant, Jaren Jackson Jr. era, success, hey, what's going on in the half court? Why is it only Ja Morant pick and roll? Hey, can they get something in the half court? We've talked about this over and over again. They tried mm-hmm. something, didn't work. Now they're trying something else, and they're trying to figure it out. On the flip side, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of injuries in Memphis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A lot of injuries in Memphis. So we are having different lineup combinations than we expected. If we're running two-way motion and we're trying to have movement and we're building this out so we have more playmaking, more random cuts from the weak side, great timed passes, we're kind of supposed to have the playmaking of Ty Jerome and Scottie Pippen Jr., and the mm-hmm. roles from Zach Edey and Brandon Clark. It's kind of greased the wheels a little bit. You also have a scenario where team is learning the new offense, the new philosophy, and you have a scenario where you're trying to figure out, how do I integrate some of this talent into this offense, into this philosophy? Mm-hmm. How do I blend that together? And I think that's, as a coach, can be a difficult thing because you are to enhance the team and make the most out of what you have. Sometimes if you have a philosophy, how do you balance that trumping what you have? Mm-hmm. Or can you get them to fit into that? What's the balance? What's the comfort like for everyone? Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing that stands out when you watch the Memphis Grizzlies. There's a lot more thinking going out there than playing. And I think mm-hmm. to me, that's one of those moments where you gotta understand and kind of give a little bit of grace, because they end up being stagnant. They have less ball movement. They have more one pass possessions. It doesn't end up well. Go ahead, guys.
No, I'm just glad you mentioned the discomfort, because like, that is the number one thing that's kind of stood out to me with their half court offense at the very least. And like, to quickly ground it with Memphis Grizzlies, they're 25th in overall offense per clean the glass, 23rd in half court offense. They are 4th in transition offense. They're 12th in frequency. The transition bit obviously tied to the defense, which has also not been very good. And the injury certainly hurt on that regard, but that
– go ahead. I think that's a big key of it. So even, you know, they had success against Dallas. They were able to get stops, get out and run. We can balance things out. Against OKC, early on, we get stops. We get out and run. You know, because I saw it after the game. I was like, oh, Memphis had a big lead. I wonder how they got there. Oh, this is a lot of transition kind of off misses. Mm-hmm. Okay. That type B. Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
Yeah, OKC stopped missing threes, and then there went the transition opportunities, and then, oh, no, they got to be in the half court more. So, yeah. And that has long been across multiple cultures at this point in the Memphis era during the history of this podcast. It's, hey, the Memphis Grizzlies are like a top 12, top 10 offense. You look at the splits. Oh, they're like third in transition. They're like bottom 10 in half court offense. That's interesting. I wonder if they can figure that out. It's been like a consistent team for us when we talk about them. And so the fact that they aren't getting the same amount of stops, to your point, Steve, like that puts more of a magnifying glass on the half court offense. But the lack of comfort and the increase of thinking, I think, was a really good point from you. Because I look at how, like, Ja in particular has been at the center of this for multiple reasons at this point. But I think, one, to your point, it's tough to kind of build that kind of chemistry with all these injuries and stuff. It's probably even tougher to build this kind of chemistry and just general comfort with the system when you're also sprinkling in, like, the substitution patterns, which has been signified, like, hey, we want to play high energy, we want to play fast, we want to keep you in shorter bursts so we can just kind of keep this pressure on, which makes sense to me logically. Clearly, there are questions about what level of buy-in everyone has with that kind of substitution style. But, like, I think that also puts a wrench into we know what we're doing because we don't know who we're playing with because of injuries. We don't know how long we're playing with the cast that we're currently playing with because we're getting subbed out. Then we can't get stopped, so we don't even get all the reps that we're getting with the half-court offense are against set defenses. And so it all just kind of snowballs together.
I think the substitution pattern is going to get interesting and something to monitor. And for me, it stood out when Memphis played Dallas, right? Mm-hmm. And we're going to touch on the comfort point for Ja and Jaren Jackson Jr., because I think that was a really good one. But Ja Morant starts that game against Dallas humming. 8 points, 5 assists. Grizzlies up 23-11 with 6:05 left in the first. Guess who leaves the basketball court?
Gonna guess it's Ja Morant.
Ja Morant comes back in with 2:47 left in the first. And so basketball is a rhythm sport. Logically, I understand taking Jaren out early. You bring Jaren back in to take Ja out. You bring Ja back. You create a wave. But it's a rhythm sport. And there's a little bit of feel and touch you got to have to where if a guy has it going, maybe I push him a couple more. Mm-hmm. If a guy doesn't have it going, maybe I pull him early and bring him back in. Gets hard because you need a set rotation to a degree, but guys have to know what's earning them their minutes. Guys have to, like, there are guys who play really well right off the bench or really well right off the starting lineup. There are some guys where it takes a couple seconds for them to get the beat of the game. And if this is a scenario where we're going up, down, up, down, up, down, or it's a foul fest, I didn't really get a feel. Now my time is up. That's hard. It's hard as well because I don't have an answer or a feel for what I did wrong. How did I help the team? You know, even me, I wasn't the best basketball player, but I knew my job was to go out there, defend, and play with energy and activity. If I was doing those things, I was probably going to play until this mark. If I did it well, I was going to get a couple more. If we didn't need it, I was going to come out earlier. I knew it.
Yeah.
I don't know how much they know about what brings them success on the court as opposed to an allotted amount of time. So it makes sense logically. From a basketball standpoint, it doesn't make you feel the best sometimes because, like, let me cook. And if you have four people saying, let me cook, grumbling a little bit, that can rise up. So something to keep an eye on.
No, I think that's fair. And I think that's where we can kind of ground it with Ja Morant. As we talk about the comfort, we talk about the skills, et cetera. So there's the stint portion, which was reportedly at least part of the conversation between him and Tomas that led to the one game suspension. That game against the Lakers got weird. It was also an interesting one watching that one back because I didn't watch that game live. I just saw the reaction. I saw the clips, the post-game clip with Ja. I ended up finding like a longer one that was like 3 minutes long where he actually answered some questions, but then it was also just like, oh, well, okay, fine. But it's like, that happened. I was like, okay, let me watch this game and see what happened. Was Ja actually this, was he really disinterested to this degree? What happened? And so I watched that game and I came away like, okay, there were absolutely some pockets, particularly in the second half, where Ja could have been more engaged. And after giving the ball up, he could have been ready to cut, because we've seen that before. Matter of fact, he opened that Laker game. His first basket was literally a cut from the corner. I'm like, okay, he can be more active. He can probe a little bit more on these drives. But something that I talked to you about, Steve, in one of our watch parties, I was like, we probably could just give more credit to the Lakers for some of the gap help that they had and just the way they were able to build their shell. They didn't give up easy driving lanes. I think they frustrated Ja and Jaren. So while there was room to be more aggressive, the Lakers also did a good job of setting up shop. Which brings me to a broader point and a quick number I want to toss out, Steve. Ja Morant has seen a help defender or multiple help defenders on 86.5% of his drives per second spectrum. That is the top mark in the league among 41 players that have logged at least 100 drives to this point. Do you know what the overall Memphis number is for just the percentage of help they're seeing on drives?
What you got?
It's in the mid-70s. They're like 14th in terms of help defenders present. That should tell you what teams are prioritizing when they face the Memphis Grizzlies. You don't get literally any of this at the rim. And so to the overall comfort point, we've talked a lot about what is the three-point shot for Ja is inconsistent. What is the mid-range game for Ja? The mid-range pull-ups are inconsistent. He was an elite scorer on floaters early in his career. Like, that hasn't been the case over the last year and a half. So you don't have the three. You don't have the intermediate area. You quite literally can't get deeper into the paint without seeing three bodies. And this is where you get into like the post-game comment, or someone in Memphis asked him, like, hey, how do you kind of take in your kind of decline in efficiency at the rim? And Ja, to shorthand it, was just like, when I was doing all this driving, y'all called me reckless. Now y'all don't want me to drive. Now y'all want me to drive like that again, which was funny to me. But it's also like, to your overall point, Steve, about building that confidence level and that comfort, where is he going to find it?
Well, here's the thing, right? It's an overall deal with the Memphis Grizzlies. And so one thing, when you watch the Memphis Grizzlies, they like to have a lot of Iverson cuts. So they're going to loop people from the side, put them on the wing, have screeners in the middle of the floor. When you watch them, though, how many times you see them pointing to try and get people in the right spot? And to the overall comfort point, if you're waiting and you're trying to throw the ball to Jaren Jackson, the post, off one of those Iverson cuts, you rip him in. Is that a double team now? And now, are you moving the ball? You're able to make a defense pay. One of the hallmarks of this Memphis Grizzlies offense, even if they're pointing and trying to figure things out, is the cutting from the weak side. But if it takes 4 to 5 seconds to get into that action, get to that first screen, you need a drive. If teams are able to contain that drive, you need a cut from the wing. So that can be the beauty of it. When they get those cuts, things open up for them. But how much of the flow do they have? Because you want to go from one side, advance to the second side, get another screen, get another drive, and then play out of it. Team's able to help. What's the rotations look like? How many times can you get to what you want? And so the overall mindset you can see on the court, they want to get to that. But when it comes to having Ja on the court, right, you get to one screen, and now you get back to the other side. You're waiting. You're in rotation, and now it's Ja off ball, catching late in the clock. And now he's in a scenario where he has to create, and defenses are saying, hey, we're going to help. The passing helps. So I don't know if Ja gets enough credit for the passing. But you're looking at scenarios where we swing, we're pointing, trying to get to the next action. We're playing off of that. Teams are switching, keeping us in front. Shot clock is draining. And if Ja doesn't have the ball to kick in for three, now it's a make or miss. So if he has it going, fantastic. We feel good. On the nights he doesn't, we feel bad. And so, we're waiting. Teams are going under in pick and roll, pressure in the ball handler. You have a scenario where you talk about the comfort. The mid-range shot is there. And now this becomes Ja Morant has to take these. Ja Morant has to make these. Because if I do get dropped, I got to take this shot. I got to get to my spot. Because if we're going to switch and I have this comfort and I have this wiggle room, this is the next evolution for me. So I don't have to drive every single time. But how comfortable does he feel getting to those areas? When he's at his best this season, gotten downhill, got the floater going, got a couple mid-range pull-ups to go, and now we're humming a little bit. And that's kind of the Ja Morant getting downhill, being able to finish in the paint. That's his comfort level. But how many times has he been able to get to it? How many times has he been able to get to it? And so when you look at the efficiency, that takes away the fact that he's turning the corner and getting in the paint and how much Memphis needs those passes, especially even if teams are going under. He's making that initial pass to help try and force them into rotation, and that's the balance. But to your point, I don't know how comfortable he is because you have defenses going under, ready to switch, and now you're hoping someone else makes play. And when he makes that kick, teams are helping off him. So when you have these high screens and you have three defenders meeting you in the paint, you got to make them pay. So does he get credit for making the reads, or are we just looking at the shooting percentages? And how much do you want the pull-up three to try and get a curveball to where, please, defend me higher on the court? And I think an underrated aspect is the Jaren Jackson Jr. portion, because his improvement has said, teams, we're going to show more help. That opens up shots for the Grizzlies, but it also takes away the drives a little bit. So if we try and go inverted for him, okay, we're just going to sit back. You can have this space. If he's a scenario where he catches a swing on the perimeter, there are like two or three defenders looking at him saying, hey, you don't get to drive either, buddy. Like, not you. And now that puts them in a position where they're getting later in the clock because of that. So you're taking Jaw off the board to a degree. You're taking Jaren off the board to a degree. They don't have comfortable sets or actions where they can consistently get what they want. Everyone's trying to learn the system of pointing at each other to try and get in. There's injuries. It's a lot.
It's a whole lot. And I'm glad you flowed into Jaren there. Because Jaren has quietly been one of the most efficient or productive drivers in the league this year, Steve. The problem is that the volume is just way down from what it was last year. Last season, logged about 17 drives per 100 possessions last year. This year, that's around 10. It's really like 9.8 or something like that. So, like, you shave that off, even with the bump in efficiency for him, nearly 1.3 points per possession on those, which is insane. The fact that you can't get to them consistently is kind of tough. And even when you do, like, some of these finishes from Jaren have been tough. You know what possession had me in a headlock? It intrigued me when I saw it live.
Which one?
But as I kept watching it back, I was like, ooh, this just feels like the Memphis Grizzlies in a nutshell. As we have this conversation, opening offensive possession for Memphis against the Thunder. It was Ja bringing the ball up the floor. You get Jalen Wells setting a pin down for Jaren Jackson Jr. It's like, okay, I like this. They're inverting the offense. That's cool. Now, this did come after Ja walking the ball up the floor. So Jaren gets this screen at 16. So to your point about it's taking X amount of time to even get into your first stuff. Sorry, cool. It's about 8 seconds before Jaren gets that screen. Cool, middle of the floor. As Jaren gets the ball, it is now Ja Morant flaring off of a screen from Jott Landale. KCP, who is in the left corner, he's kind of lifting up. Looks like it's like Spain, but it's not. But he's kind of clears that corner. And I pause. I'm just like, hey, I like this. You get Jaren involved early. You get Ja off the ball. You get Ja catching the ball on the move. He's going to have the entire left side of the floor. Let's see if we can beat you to a spot. I like the design of this. The problem is that, one, again, it took this long to even get into this portion of the program. Two, Cason Wallace is ducking under all of this. And so as Ja gets the ball and gets ready to set up the drive, Cason Wallace has met him on the other side, which hat tip to Cason Wallace, who's having himself one heck of a year. We talked about on the pod. But it's just like, well, good design. None of this matters yet. But then we get to the next phase. Because of where Ja catches it and where Ja Landale is, cool. Empty side pick and roll with Ja Morant inside the three-point line with Jaren Jackson Jr. one pass away, which means if OKC is going to load this nail help that they'd like to do, it's coming from Isaiah Hartenstein instead of like one of the guards with the quick hands that can force turnovers. Like, okay, even structurally, I get that. Cool. You go with this pick and roll, Cason Wallace ducks under again. It's like, well, darn. Or tries to duck under, ends up getting clipped by Ja. You pass it to Jaren Jackson Jr. He's attacking from the three-point line while KCP is now once again clearing space with a cut, to your point about Memphis trying to get to the cutting. Jaren finishes, but by the time he finishes, he's dealing with a contest from Isaiah Hartenstein. He's dealing with Chet Holmgren, who is now rolling to the basket. And it's just like, you zoom out, Jaren off ball, invert the offense, Ja Morant off a flare, Ja Morant empty side pick and roll, Jaren Jackson drive. You got the two best players involved, you got them involved off movement. Sounds good. OKC didn't care about almost any of it. And the shot that you actually got, points on the board, was a tough one. And it's just like, how am I supposed to feel about that? Because I like this. I don't like how they're being treated. And you got to build a boat out of this. It's just a tough spot. And so, like, I would like for them to get healthier. I would like for some of the, I guess, the non-Cedric Howard shooting to be better. Because he's just been a real bright spot for them. We just talked about him on the Rookie Report. Quick plug. But it's just... is tough. is tough for them. And I just want to see that get better.
Understood. Understood. It's not easy. But I think the volume in which I understand the takes, which one of these things opens things up for Memphis, if that makes sense, is the one for me. Is it more comfort? Mm-hmm. Is it getting healthy? Is it Ja being able to find comfort or make the shots? I mean, I think it's, sometimes if he's just able to make those floaters, have a hot night. Jaren Jackson mm-hmm. Jr. is able to make some of those shots and get some more opportunities on drives, that could open things up. And there's a base. The second unit has more to work with within the flow of the system. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of piecing it together.
Yeah. And in order for the season to turn around and to quiet some of the noise on a Ja versus coach or a Ja trade room, yada, 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 you just want more consistent production. You want more shooting. You want a little bit more pace. They're still technically playing faster than most teams in the league, but it is just a noticeable dip from where they were last year in terms of pace. How quickly they're getting the ball over, how long their possessions are lasting, when they get to their first stuff. Like, all of those little margins matter when you're dealing with this amount of injury. And, you know, it's just been weird. It's just been weird. So, I think that's our Memphis spiel. Hopefully things get better on that front. While we're here, and while I'm just annoyed by process things, hey, the Los Angeles Clippers. We can just turn this segment into Nekias Takes the L if you want. The post up / Nekias Takes the L. So I was very excited about this Clippers group. that's two. We got to get a little counter on here. But I was also very excited about the Clippers. I'm like, hey, James Harden, very good. Kawhi Leonard, very good. Ivica Zubac, very good. You got this trio. You add more depth. Even if it's older depth, you at least get to a point where, okay, we can mix and match. We can rest some guys. We feel like they're doing too much. We just have more options at our disposal. This should be a good regular season team, at least to me, in my eyes. And as of recording, the Los Angeles Clippers are 3-7, and they are in the bottom 10 in offense and defense. Kawhi's missed some time already. Bradley Beal is dealing with a hip injury that appears is going to have him out for a while. So we'll see. We've already gotten a lineup change. When we talked about the Clippers a little bit last week, I was like, hey, at the end of the segment, I would like to see Chris Dunn starting. He has started the last four games. Looks like with Bradley Beal out, we're probably going to see more John Collins in the starting lineup too. So we'll see if that turns. But it all just feels so rigid, Steve. And I don't like how rigid it feels. The tempo has felt off all year long. And like, you can get away with that to a degree when you have James Harden, who is just playing incredible basketball this year. So this isn't really a James Harden criticism. But like, you can generally get away with slower tempo as a concept when you can just shepherd possessions in the way that James Harden does. Like, I can walk this up because I can poke at matchups. I can make any pass in the book. It's fine. But when you're now dealing with injuries and you're facing set defenses more often because teams are just blitzing you in transition, whenever you miss, you can't get back, you can't match up, etc. It does shrink the margin for error. And so now some of these walk-up possessions, the fact that they are dealing with more full court pressure, like it's up across the league, but the Clippers in particular are facing that more than literally anyone except the Los Angeles Lakers as of recording. You're getting that into slow half-court offense where the screening hasn't hit the way that I anticipated it to. The Zubac post-ups have once again been good, but like, they don't feel like they're in the flow like they were last year. I just don't like where they're at right now. It's making me sad. I think the defense certainly has to shape up. I think some of the lineup tweaks, some of the rotation tweaks should help on that front. But like, the transition defense has to be better. The half court defense has to be better. Like, to that end, Zubac hasn't been the same rim protector this year. Some of that is roster context, but some of that is just, hey, you're not navigating space in these recoveries as well as you did last year. He has to be better in that regard. And they just have to find some level of consistency, period. They have the talent. Like, they could have won against Atlanta last night if they were able to string together more possessions late in that game. But, like, it's just made me sad what the teams look like. It's looking like I'm going to be very wrong on the regular season Los Angeles Clippers, at least at this point.
Understood. Speaking of wrong, it'd be wrong of you to not come back after we take this break.
Thank you.
And we are back, and we're going to hang around the elbow, Steve. Let's get into some player shout-outs, some players that have intrigued us. I will kick things off. Hello, OG Anunoby. Averaging a career high in New York right now, 18.2 points per game, 55% on twos, 44% on threes, Steve. He's taken over seven a game. 76 for the line, six boards, two assists, two steals. The defense has remained at an all-defense level. One of my favorite things about the OG Anunoby experience is when he just decides off the ball, oh, cool action that you think you're about to run. I'm just going to pickpocket this, or I'm just going to jump this pass, and we're going the other way. Try it again next possession. You're probably not going to have fun either. The defense has remained very good, but to the threes. This has been like an overall thing with Mike Brown. He wants these guys to be more comfortable. Five games already of seven or more three-point attempts for OG Anunoby through his first nine games. It took 13 games last year for him to reach that mark. He's taking them with more abandon. Doesn't care as much about closeouts. When he does see closeouts, he's abusing those with those three made threes or getting downhill. The drives are up, even if the efficiency isn't quite there. I've just enjoyed the two-way impact of OG Anunoby so far this year.
Fantastic. You know what I've enjoyed?
Ooh.
De'Aaron Fox reminding the world that he's very good at basketball. And he, matter of fact, he said it himself after making his debut. And I just don't understand the world where people are like, you know what, we don't need De'Aaron Fox. He's very good. He's a closer. He gets downhill. He gets buckets. Respect De'Aaron Fox.
I did appreciate it. What was it, a 15-point second quarter? I mean, yeah, man, I'm good at basketball. This is the coverage I'm going to see. This is what I can do. So, welcome edition. We had a little bit of what's going on with the Spurs offense. His team was throwing some junk at him, but looks much better with De'Aaron Fox in tow. And also, Victor Wembanyama is just insane. So, like the Fox shout there. Quickly for me, hasn't been the most fun in New Orleans. We did just talk about Jeremiah Fears and Derek Queen on the last rookie report. Hello, Trey Murphy III, shaking off a cold start to the year. First four games, averaged about 13 points per game, shot 22% from three, under 50% on twos, which is unlike him, anything we've seen since his rookie year. Last six games for Trey Murphy III, 21.7 points, 57% on twos, 43% on threes on high volume, 91 from the line, seven boards a game, has been a career high rebound a season, and he is having some fun on the offensive glass in particular. So that's been cool. Nearly four assists over these last six games. Just had 41-9 against San Antonio. And like what I've appreciated about the Trey Murphy experience, not necessarily reinventing the wheel, but like they have been very intentional about getting him the ball on the move. Start you in the corner. Here's a wide pin down. Are we going to curl you from the corner? Get you a touch. Now you're a dribble away from the rim, where he, similar to what we talked about during the preseason, absorbing contact better, seeking out contact more. He's making easy kicks from there if teams help early. And so like that interior comfort, in addition to he can bomb away from pretty much anywhere. He's still spotting up 30 feet from the basket when he doesn't have the ball. It's just a dynamic that I've enjoyed in the midst of what this Pelican season has been. So wanted to give a quick shout out to Trey Murphy III. Really heating up right now.
Speaking of dynamics, Stephon Castle. I'm sticking with the Spurs.
Okay. I like it.
Averaging 10 assists a night in this month of November. The last three games, 19-11 against the Bulls, 16-13 against the Pelicans, 14-13 against the Rockets. He's making the reads. Mm-hmm. And so if you put that on top of the athleticism, and you put that on top of the aggression, and you put that on top of the defense, which, by the way, them very quietly asking him to guard a little bit of everybody is something you should keep an eye on. But Stephon Castle is putting it together in a way that I think people should pay attention to.
I like the Stephon Castle shout. Hashtag go Huskies. While we're talking about playmaking, going to go off the board a little bit. Hasn't been the most fun in Brooklyn. Again, that is the first L that I've taken already. But shout out to Nick Claxton. Healthier. Looks better. The drives are hitting. The playmaking is up. Last five games for Nick Claxton, Steve, 17 points per game, converting 76% of his twos, nearly eight boards, three of those on the offensive glass, five assists a game, a steal, and two blocks, 25 assists to eight turnovers during this stretch. I have enjoyed, as much as I can, the chemistry that he's been building with Michael Porter Jr. Like, they have pretty much taken some of those Denver actions for MPJ, starting around the baseline, off-ball screen, curl up, like the good DHO or whatever. But then you're making reads from there. It's like, sometimes I'm coming all the way off of this. Sometimes I'm going to reject that screen. I'm going to dart back door. Nick Claxton is seeing that. If you have some of the stagger set up with MPJ starting in the corner, you don't know if he's coming off of both of those or if he's going to curl in. They've had a nice little mind meld there. And again, Nick Claxton with space, He is chewing up that space as a driver. He's getting into some of these Euro steps and some of these extension finishes. 42 drives so far this year, 1.2 points per possession on any trip featuring a Nick Claxton drive so far. That is fifth among 126 players with at least 40 drives right now. The four players ahead, Julius Randle, Trey Jones, Austin Reeves, and funny enough, Jaren Jackson Jr. So wanted to give the quick salute to Nick Claxton. We see you, big dog.
You know who we need to give a salute to, right?
Sure.
Norman Powell. Norman Powell of the Miami Heat. You want to be sad about the Clippers, be excited for Norman Powell. This man is cooking.
Yeah. It probably makes the Clippers more sad.
He's the first player in Miami Heat history to record 6 20-point games in their first 7 games as a member of the Heat. And then he had 33 against the Cleveland Cavaliers and made play after play. And you want to talk about how Coach Spo has reinvented himself and how he has brought the belief in this team and it made this team go offensively. This works a lot better when Norman Powell is driving all over the place and consistently getting you buckets. So a salute to Norman Powell for what he's brought to the table for Miami.
Heck of a win for the Miami Heat on Monday night. Doing business with no Bam Adebayo. Go ahead.
Well, real quick, just prayers up to Coach Spo. Salute to Coach Spo.
Yeah, as someone that has literally dealt with the house, that is a terrifying experience. So I hope he is okay and his family is okay as they can be with those circumstances. So thank you for that, Steve, as well. Quickly for me, Mo Gay in Atlanta, since we're just going to stick in the Southeast right now, 7 points, 4 boards, and about a block per game. Doesn't sound like much. 70% on twos, career high. 37% from three from Mo Gay. I think you take that if you're Atlanta. He will defend a little bit of everyone. That is always fun. He's taking on Paolo. He's taking on a little bit of Franz. He's got the guard. Chet Holmgren, Brandon Ingram. Like, they just toss him around, and he is up for the challenge. So that part's been fun. Just had 21-7-7 against the Lakers, in which head coach J.J. Redick was not pleased at all with his Los Angeles Lakers for losing that one. But he was all over the place, and I've just enjoyed the two-way energy that he's provided. So quick shout-out to Mo Gay, as they are still trying to find some footing without Trae Young right now.
Fantastic, Nikias. And let me tell you, I don't have any free throws, so hit the horns. Take us home.
Oh, okay. Ooh, quick, one more. Just want to say a quick salute to Trendon Watford. 10-6-4 so far since he's come back. 13-75 over his last 5 games. Passing's been fun. The random post-ups. The short role playmaking. I've enjoyed the Trendon Watford experience. Glad he's healthy. The Sixers are fun. Now,
Bro, you going to cut off the end of the show to mention Trendon Watford?
Yeah. Showstopper.
Have you no shame? What? He didn't even say the man had a triple-double. Man, get us out of here.
He did. I was trying to go quick. Anyway, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of the Dunker Spot Podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports YouTube channel. We're here every Tuesday, every Friday. So rock with us. Continue to rock with us. Have some fun. You can catch me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can catch Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.